Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Richard Rhodes. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 22 books, including The Making of the Atomic Bomb, Dark Sun, and Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race. And there will be a reading of his new play, Reykjavik, tomorrow night, Tuesday, August 18th, by Umbrella Hat Productions, a new theater company based in New York City and producing several plays in Santa Fe this summer. Richard Rhodes will be in attendance to discuss the play with the audience after the reading. The reading is co-sponsored by the Atomic Heritage Foundation, the Los Alamos Committee on Arms Control and International Security, and the Los Alamos Historical Society. The reading will take place at El Museo Cultural in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Your play is a dramatization of the Reykjavik Summit of 1986, and this was the historic meeting between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, whose intention was to eliminate nuclear weapons from the planet. What was happening in the United States and the Soviet Union at that time that made such a summit possible and desirable?
You know, Reagan really did not realize what Gorbachev meant to bring to the table that weekend. There were plans for a summit in Washington the following spring, and Gorbachev suggested that they might want to get together beforehand to kind of set some things up that maybe they could then sign at the summit in Washington. So Reagan arrived thinking that not much was going to be happening except some more of the kind of personal conversation that the two had already begun at Geneva the previous year. So he was immensely surprised when he discovered that Gorbachev had an entire package to offer that was fundamentally to reduce and eventually get rid of all nuclear weapons in exchange for a delay in the deployment of Reagan's great dream of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars. So it really was not something that was planned, at least on the American side, and it was quite a shock when the Americans realized what Gorbachev was up to.
What was Gorbachev's motivation in bringing all of that to the table?
Gorbachev took office about the previous April as someone who had grown up through the Soviet system, not as one of the city slickers in Moscow, but as a farmer's son. He had won a scholarship to Moscow University, where he studied law, by actually threshing more wheat in one summer than any other 17-year-old in the Soviet Union. Gorbachev's first job when he joined the Central Committee of the Communist Party was as Minister of Agriculture. And he was vastly puzzled by the realization that a country as bounteous as the Soviet Union couldn't even feed its own people. And as he began to look around to try to understand why, he realized that one of the big problems was a hugely bloated defense budget, worse in terms of a percentage of national income than the United States. Some estimates as high as 40% of the Soviet national income was devoted to defense. So in thinking about how he could transform his country into one that was better for its people, which really was his intention, he realized that the first thing to do was to reduce the defense budget, but that in order to do that, he would have to come to some accommodation with the United States. So he arrived through that logical process at the realization that the sooner the Cold War could be ended, the better off for the people of his nation. And clearly, the first step in getting rid of the defense budget would be dealing with the worst weapons, which were nuclear weapons. So that's the reason he came to Reykjavik with this package in his pocket that he hoped to convince Reagan to agree to.
What was the role of popular movements around the world? Certainly, there were
disarmament and anti-nuclear movements happening in various places, including Europe and the United States.
You know, the Soviet Union and the United States both rarely paid much attention politically to the anti-nuclear movement, unless it suited our or their particular propaganda purposes. The Soviets were delighted with the movement toward zero in Europe of European nuclear weapons because that played into their hands. But Ronald Reagan was quite opposed to the idea that the Europeans would eliminate nuclear weapons or push off American nuclear weapons. To the contrary, he saw the idea of installing, and this was happening just at the time of the Reykjavik summit, of installing a new class of medium-range nuclear missiles in Europe that would have delivery times to the Soviet Union of 5 to 10 minutes, basically something that there would be no way whatsoever to deter. He had a larger purpose in that, however. He was hoping that the Soviet Union would agree to eliminate their missiles in Europe in exchange for our agreeing not to put missiles in Europe. Not a very good deal from the point of view of the costs involved, but a good deal in terms of national security on both sides. So the play of the public concern about nuclear weapons, I think, never had much influence on the leadership of either country, except very early on, and that was in the pressure to eliminate atmospheric nuclear testing. That did work, and both countries in the 1960s moved their nuclear testing underground.
Did anybody else in the world have nuclear weapons at that point?
Oh, yes. 1986, there were seven or eight nuclear powers in the world, five declared and three or four undeclared, in order of their appearance on the scene: the United States, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, China. And then, of course, as well, Israel, but never a declared nuclear power, but certainly it was. India and Pakistan were working in that direction. So there were quite a few nuclear powers in the world. And indeed, there would have been quite a few more had there not been a wonderful treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, that was promoted jointly by the United States and the Soviet Union in the 1960s after the near disaster of the Cuban Missile Crisis, with the realization, as John Kennedy said at the time, that if we didn't get a handle on nuclear proliferation, there might be 20 or 30 nuclear powers in the world 20 years down the road. The reason there aren't today is certainly because of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which made a bargain among the five declared nuclear powers and the other 160 countries that are signatories, that they would not, that the nuclear powers would not attack a non-nuclear power with nuclear weapons, that they would share peaceful nuclear technology, nuclear energy, and so on with those countries, and that they would work with serious effort toward eliminating their nuclear arsenals, something that really had not, up to the time of the Reykjavik summit, been taken very seriously by the nuclear powers. Again, so Gorbachev came to the table with a lot of history behind him and his country and us and our country and the other nuclear powers of trying to limit the spread of these most terrible weapons of mass destruction.
If the summit had been successful, it presumably would have served as an example to all of the lesser nuclear powers and everybody else.
Well, in fact, of course, if Gorbachev and Reagan had agreed, as they came very close to doing, on an effort to rid the entire world of nuclear weapons, they would, as they discussed, they would have begun with their own arsenals, which were hugely more numerous than any other arsenal. The United States and the Soviet Union had about, and still do, about 96% of all the nuclear weapons in the world, and the other 4% are divided among the other countries. So, I mean, 25,000 in the Soviet Union, 15,000 in the United States, and just hundreds in the other nuclear countries. So they would have started, as they discussed, by reducing their own arsenals, which is, of course, what we now are, in fact, doing today. One of the reasons I think this play is relevant to current events. And then at some point, they would have drawn in the other nuclear powers and forged multilateral agreements for mutual reductions. It would have gotten very tricky, and it will get very tricky, as we continue to move towards zero, as we're doing today, when you get down into the numbers, into just a few nuclear weapons. And that's where the problem of the Strategic Defense Initiative was troubling to Soviet experts, because if the United States had even a modest shield against a nuclear attack, it could easily be overwhelmed when the other side had a lot of weapons in its arsenal. But if there are only 5 or 10 left, it might be able to prevent an attack from the other side and thus open the way to a first strike from our side. And this was the kind of mistrust that was going to have to be dealt with in the course of eliminating nuclear weapons, and of course still will be, have to be dealt with today.
We're talking to Richard Rhodes, author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb and the new play Reykjavik.
Let's talk more about the Strategic Defense Initiative. It was Reagan's idea, of which he was very proud. He thought of it as a truly effective shield against nuclear weapons. For Gorbachev, it was an arms race in space. What was the actual nature of the program?
You know, our SDI program is very strange, was very strange. It wasn't developed out of technological advances within, let's say, our national weapons laboratories. It was concocted by Reagan's kitchen cabinet of wealthy Republican advisors out in California as a way for the Republican Party to seem to be strong on defense without having to commit itself to negotiations, which were anathema to the Republican right and still are. So the idea was the Democrats could talk about negotiating peace treaties or various treaties with the Soviet Union, and that would make them look ostensibly weak on defense, whereas the Republicans could produce this robust idea of technological security. And it had always been an issue across the years of the Cold War, whether or not we should protect ourselves with technological security or whether we should negotiate and use the equipment of diplomacy to make ourselves safer. We had used both, of course, but it had long been a kind of a political, domestic political issue in the United States between the two parties. The Republicans would typically get themselves reelected by presenting the Democrats as weak on defense. So Star Wars was for Reagan. Well, let me step back a moment. Ronald Reagan had puzzled deeply over the question of how to prevent nuclear war ever since the beginning of the post-war period in 1945. He had tried to think of a way that nuclear weapons could be eliminated without encountering the risk of some other country cheating, keeping a few weapons in a cave somewhere, or reconstituting their nuclear arsenal. And when he went on a tour of the big U.S. facility in Colorado, where we keep track of all the things orbiting and flying across space, he was struck by the fact that we could keep track of a astronaut's glove in orbit, as someone told him. And it seemed to him then that if we could do that, we ought to be able to devise some sort of space-based system that would be able to keep track of incoming Soviet warheads and shoot them down before they reached the United States. This was encouraged, this idea, which really is technologically way beyond anywhere we are now or certainly were then, was encouraged by Dr. Edward Teller, who had always believed that more armaments and bigger armaments and better armaments were the only reliable way to keep the Soviets out. Teller convinced Reagan that there could be such a thing as an X-ray laser, which would orbit the Earth and keep track of Soviet warheads and shoot them down with a burst of energy from its, as it turns out, nuclear weapons that would pump this thing. But anyway, the whole idea, which was really presented as a political ploy, for Reagan deemed to be the solution to the basic dilemma that he had been puzzling over for more than a decade, more than two decades. And with that, and with all the excitement of the recent convert, he saw or believed that it would now be possible to put an end to the nuclear arsenals of the world, protected behind an impenetrable shield. As he told Gorbachev so often during the Reykjavik discussions, that Gorbachev finally at one point covered his ears and said, yes, yes, I've heard of that 10 times now. He said, you know, it's like a gas mask, Mr. Gorbachev. When we outlawed poison gas, he said, after the end of the First World War, we didn't outlaw gas masks. So SDI would just be a kind of gas mask to protect us in case anyone cheated. So at the heart, Reagan's intentions were really of the best. But because the whole structure he had built up in his mind as a solution to the problem was anchored in the idea of some kind of perfect defensive shield, he was not able finally to commit to Gorbachev's proposal. Gorbachev proposed that they would begin eliminating all nuclear weapons in exchange for a 10-year delay in the movement of SDI out of the laboratory and into space. That's all the Soviets asked for, but it was more than Reagan could agree to. And it was, unfortunately, Gorbachev's bottom line because of the negotiation he had previously had with his military, which took Star Wars seriously because they couldn't imagine why the United States would have dumped $20 billion into researching something that was a pie-in-the-sky will-o'-the-wisp, though, in fact, we had done so.
I mean, this is something that I think needs to be really clarified. I mean, there's this moment where you bring the ghost of Robert Oppenheimer into the play, the inventor of the atomic bomb, and he reminds us, among other things, that in these negotiations there are never physicists, there are never actual scientists. What was the reality? Is there such a thing as an effective shield against missiles?
No, there isn't. Because you can always overwhelm it. The offense is always cheaper than the defense. The system that we're working on today, which is ground-based, would involve firing very high-velocity warheads in the direction of incoming warheads and hitting a bullet with a bullet, as they say. Well, the problem with nuclear weapons is it doesn't take very many to cause absolutely catastrophic damage. If only, as I noticed one military document from this era pointed out, if only 5% of a Russian first strike, let's say, a Soviet first strike, had gotten through such a shield, that would be enough nuclear weapons to destroy every major city in the United States. Under those circumstances, as people, I think, are slowly coming to realize, there is no defense. For many decades, we hoped that our defense would be deterrence, which is a kind of mutual hostage situation where if you attack us, we're going to have enough weapons in a secure reserve to attack you even if we are destroyed in the process. Therefore, the theory goes you won't want to attack us because it would be basically mutual suicide. Well, that's all very well, or was all very well, as long as we were discussing nations which are presumably rational actors. But since 9/11, it's become clear to everybody that to the extent that it might be possible for a subnational group, let's say Al-Qaeda, to acquire or even build a few nuclear weapons, they don't have a home address. They don't have any assets that they hold that we could hold at risk and that would deter them. And I think more than anything else, it's that fact that has led to a renewed move on the United States' part and other countries to rethink the whole idea of going to zero, of getting rid of nuclear weapons. Because if you have people who potentially can strike you with nuclear weapons and there's no way to deter them, then you are absolutely vulnerable. And the only way you can eliminate that vulnerability is either to eliminate them in advance, as the Bush administration tried with Iraq, to our great sorrow, or to decide that you're going to get rid of all the nuclear weapons in the world and meet the security needs of every institution in the world. A tall order indeed, but maybe not so tall an order as people have once thought.
We're talking to Richard Rhodes. When you say rational actor, I think of the moment where Ronald Reagan talks in the play about how he truly believed in Armageddon as he saw it laid out in the Bible, and he saw himself as the man to postpone Armageddon just long enough for the U.S. to spread democracy across the world, contrasted to Gorbachev's aims. He looks really pretty ungrounded in reality.
Well, you know, that's actually true. Reagan really did talk about the idea that nuclear war was clearly, in his mind, the Battle of Armageddon foretold in the Book of Revelation. He may well have believed that at some level, but, you know, does it really matter what someone's motivations are as long as they're going down the right track? I don't think so, and I think I leave it that way in the play for that reason. I mean, a nuclear war would be a kind of Armageddon in that, as we now understand, and really didn't. In fact, the idea about nuclear winter as an outcome of a major nuclear war was just being developed by the scientific community at the time of the Reykjavik summit. But since then, with much better atmospheric models, because of all the work that's been done on global warming, it's now possible to say with considerable certainty that even a relatively small nuclear exchange, for example, 50 Hiroshima-scale atomic bombs on India and 50 in exchange on Pakistan, which would necessarily be used to destroy cities in both countries, would produce a worldwide nuclear, I don't know whether you call it winter or not, but a worldwide reduction in average annual temperatures of 2 to 3 degrees, which sounds modest, but in fact, the last time such a thing happened in the world was during a medieval period of great cold when crops failed around the world, there were hard freezes in July, and millions of people starved to death. So the question really becomes, how few nuclear weapons can there be in the world without triggering these large global atmospheric meteorological effects that would affect us all? We're talking about not more than 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs is a total of 1.5 megatons. We have individual warheads that have more explosive force than that.
So you're basically saying that one warhead would be 50 to 100 Hiroshimas right there. So it wouldn't be 50 exchanges, it would be one exchange.
Well, but the effect has to be, what we're talking about here is burning cities. And it's the fact that cities are full of combustible materials that leads to the mass fires that produce the soot and the oxides that reduce the insulation of the atmosphere. So it does take a few weapons. But it doesn't evidently take very many to cause global effects. You know, you think about the Iraqi attack on the oil wells in Kuwait, and that some people thought that might lead to global effects. It wasn't a large enough scale amount of pollution, but a small nuclear war would certainly do the job and would kill, again, to take the India-Pakistan model, would kill upwards of 16 to 20 million people. I defy you to tell me what would remain of anybody's trust and admiration for democracy or the American system if such a thing were to happen at our hands, that 15 to 20 million people were killed.
When I hear you talk, it scares me a little bit that somebody would say, oh, well, there you have a 1 to 2 degree drop in global temperature to offset the effects of global warming.
I've seen at least one poor soul who actually made that comment half seriously. If you want to kill 20 million people in order to improve the situation with global warming, then I think you should be buried in a dungeon somewhere.
It's fascinating in your play to watch the two sides play out, Reagan and Gorbachev. And at moments, it's sort of painful to see the difference in intelligence and wisdom between the two leaders. And yet you paint both characters as sympathetic.
Well, I don't know about intelligence and wisdom. I mean, Gorbachev was an extremely bright, well-educated, rational human being. Ronald Reagan was perhaps not as well-educated, someone whom his colleagues said could only think in stories. I'm not sure that's a vice, but he wasn't particularly skilled at abstract thought. But his heart was in the right place. He knew how to use his authority. He knew how to negotiate. And it's only perhaps because moving directly from ending the Cold War to eliminating all the nuclear weapons in the world was a bridge too far at that point in time. Remember, there was still a functioning Soviet Union in 1986. And we had no idea in 1986 that it was going to fold up and blow away within 5 years. We still saw it as the juggernaut it had been for the previous 40. So they probably were overreaching a bit. But within the boundaries of what they were doing, they were very much equals. And I think Gorbachev came away finally. I mean, he had a lot of bad things to say about Reagan when he got back to the Politburo, but that was the kind of song and dance that he was always doing with those people so that he could put things over on them and get done what he hoped to get done. He was not a city slicker, and the city slickers, he walked past them 15 times every day. So both these two men had something in common, though. They were both outsiders. They both didn't come up within the national security establishments of their respective countries. They came in from elsewhere, and they brought with them a different set of assumptions and a different set of values. And I think that's why they were able to come so close. And in the end, after all, Gorbachev was able to say to the press conference after the summit, and in a way he was able to turn around what had looked like a terrible failure into a success by saying this was not an end, this was a beginning. We broke through here. We agreed to get rid of an entire class of nuclear weapons, the ones that were in Europe, and he said, And more than that, we both, he didn't say it in these words, we both went up to the mountaintop and looked over the other side. So I don't presume to judge Ronald Reagan's intelligence. I do think he did something quite extraordinary. And if he couldn't go all the way, well, neither could Moses, you know.
The characters at the sides of these two leaders are just as important, and you paint a pretty sinister picture of Richard Pearl. You call him your Iago. And his role was really to undermine the negotiations, and he did.
He did, in fact, I think so.
What was his motivation? What did he believe? At the bottom, what was he trying to achieve?
You know, Pearl was a neoconservative, and still is. The kind of values that the neoconservatives had and have were best illustrated by the business in the George W. Bush administration of taking on Iraq rather than, let's say, letting the inspection process that was ongoing in Iraq after 1991 play itself out, which would have resulted ultimately in our realizing that Iraq didn't have any nuclear arsenal nor even any program to build one after we shut it down after the first Gulf War. So the point of view of the neoconservatives was basically that you don't trust the other side, you don't negotiate with the other side, you apply constant pressure to the other side, military and otherwise, and you try basically to break them down and destroy them in every possible way. People don't realize that during the first term of the Reagan era, we were doing things like overflying some of the outlying islands of the Soviet Union. We were using our Navy ships to make run-ins toward the Russian shore with all of their electronics turned off, and then at the last minute, we would turn everything on, the radars and everything else, and scare the hell out of the Soviets' specialists who were trying to keep track of protecting their borders. All of this was going on deliberately to provoke and disturb another major nuclear power. In looking into it, I absolutely found it appalling. But that was the mentality that was there behind the scenes with Reagan. And again, they were the ones who were most appalled that the president would even consider the idea that we might get rid of our nuclear arsenal. Their idea was to build it even further and to scare the Russians even more, as if somehow that would make them less dangerous to us. So from Pearl's point of view, the whole thing, the whole business of his being at the Reykjavik summit was to make sure, to the best of his ability, he was a third-level official at best, he was the Deputy Secretary of Defense at that time, was to make sure that we didn't give anything away. And when he saw the president moving in the direction of this grand bargain with the Soviet Union, he really did feel he had to come up with something that would stop things in its tracks. And much of what I show him doing in the play, and most of the dialogue, is actually authentic. And it did finally come down to Reagan asking somewhat uncertainly of the people around him, George Shultz and the others, including Richard Pearl, look, if I do this, if I agree with Gorbachev and delay the deployment of SDI, will I simply be doing it to make a deal, or is it a good deal? And Shultz said, Mr. President, it's the best deal I've seen in 25 years of negotiating with the Russians. We can settle this thing with SDI down the road in our negotiations in Geneva, take the deal. And so did everyone else in the room until he got to Pearl. And Pearl said, Mr. President, it will destroy SDI. He knew where Reagan was vulnerable. That's why I call him Iago.
Yeah.
He plays the same role in this story as Iago did in Othello. He found the point of vulnerability and he pushed it. And Reagan backed off and left the decision unmade.
We're talking to Richard Rhodes, author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb and the new play Reykjavik.
There's this whole question of superiority versus equality. In other words, when a nation or an animal in a wolf pack is on top, it wants to maintain its superiority, whereas everybody else wants to have more of a say in what's going on. And this has been played out in world politics forever. And you have people who want a so-called multipolar world and those who want a unipolar world in which they're on top.
Sure.
Where do we stand now?
Well, first, where did we stand then? And let's be clear, one of the real paradoxes of nuclear weapons, and I think the one that confused and confounded people more than anything else, is that once you have enough, the fact that somebody else has twice as many makes no difference whatsoever. You're just, as one military man memorably said, you're just making the rubble bounce. So it was this really difficult problem to understand how you reach security on all sides, not just us, but the Soviets had the same problem. Everyone has the same problem in a nuclear world. How do you reach security when only a few nuclear weapons are enough to destroy a society? Gorbachev had come to understand that the answer was what had been developed in European discussions, particularly between Germany, West Germany, and the Soviet Union, as the breakdown in Germany came to an end in the early 1980s and the later 1980s, something that the Germans called common security. Their argument was, we are now at a point in time where you can only increase your security as a nation in cooperation with your enemies, not in defiance of your enemies. And that idea was shared with Gorbachev by the Germans and by other figures in Europe as well. And he adopted it as a perspective for the Soviet Union. Thus, we could get rid of our arsenals between the United States and the Soviet Union if we both realized that doing so would make us more, not less, secure. So he was moving toward that kind of world, and so ultimately were we. But then when Dick Cheney became Secretary of Defense during the first term of the George H.W. Bush administration, beginning in 1991, he and his colleagues, who were very much of a mentality that said the only protection is to be stronger than the other guys, I mean, a sort of pre-nuclear mentality, if you will, where you could pile up more armaments than the other guy and have an advantage. His whole move, Cheney's, during the early 90s, was to design a defense system, a defense strategy that would allow the United States to come out on top and be the single superpower in the world. I mean, we were there by default because the Soviet Union had folded, but Russia still had a more than adequate, of course, nuclear arsenal. Cheney had been one of those who had tried to encourage the total breakdown of the Soviet Union. He had never trusted Gorbachev during all those years. He had assumed that Gorbachev or someone like him would reemerge as a communist in the Stalinist mode and that we would be back fighting the Cold War. Indeed, I think the people in Cheney's establishment were actively looking for a new Cold War. They made a lot of noise about China in those days. There's a famous remark that Colin Powell made around that time where he said, gee, I'm running out of enemies. I'm down to Saddam Hussein and Kim Il-sung, which was a very interesting remark. So the push toward a unipolar world, which has been the neocon dream ever since the end of the Soviet Union, is still something kind of floating around in the background, or at least it was during the second Bush administration as well. The idea was to take out Iraq cleanly and quickly, to be sure, as a way of setting an example to the rest of the Middle East and also to terrorists, because they thought that Saddam was aligned with Al-Qaeda, to put the rest of the world on notice that we were not going to let anybody do anything that would in any way threaten us. And, of course, it was a debacle. We're going to be dealing with the effects of that for years to come.
That whole comment, gee, we're running out of enemies, suggests that there are these self-sustaining bureaucracies, whether they're military bureaucracies or anything else, that want to keep themselves going just for their own sake, even when they don't have a rational purpose.
Well, they think they have a rational purpose, and to the extent that they've rationalized a rational purpose, they can be as strongly committed to that point of view as others of us might be committed to the opposite point of view. But the fact is, just to take one example of armaments, nuclear weapons today, acknowledged to be useless, acknowledged to have no function except the supposed function of deterring other nuclear weapons from being used, which, by the way, would suggest that the way to solve that is to get rid of them all, then you wouldn't have to deter something that wasn't there. Nuclear weapons still cost us around $50 to $60 billion a year to maintain in all their uselessness with all the systems that are there to deliver them and so forth. That is a huge expenditure of national wealth for no purpose whatsoever that I can see. You know, Gorbachev, by the end of his career as General Secretary in the Soviet Union, at one point said to one of his advisors, you know, I don't think that if we got rid of every last nuclear weapon today just on our own unilaterally, that anyone would attack us who has nuclear weapons. Why would Europe want to do that? Why would the United States want to do that? They're prosperous countries. They live well. They have great bounty. Why would they want to do anything that could put it at risk? And he probably was right, of course. Take that point of view and compare it to the continuing effort on the part of some parts of our defense establishment and our political leadership to foment what I call threat inflation, inflated threats. Right now, we are being told that North Korea is a threat to the United States of America. That's just extraordinary.
Right.
Now, they have maybe 10 nuclear warheads and no means of delivery except perhaps by truck down to Seoul, but certainly no means of delivery to the United States of America. The notion that they are a great threat to us is truly appalling.
We were told that Nicaragua was a threat in the 1980s.
Yes, and there again was a whole scenario dreamed up by those who said that, that somehow Nicaragua would be a flying wedge of penetration of a revolutionary attack on the United States from the South. I think when you hear things like that, after you've given them the necessary dose of common sense to realize how absurd they are, you then have to ask what the motive is of people who make up scenarios like that. And it finally comes back, and I don't mean to sound like some wild liberal, although I hope I am, it finally comes back to the fact that there's an awful lot of money involved, that there's a huge industrial establishment involved in maintaining our defense systems, that the idea that we might become a more peaceful community and find alternative ways to settle our disputes really challenges a lot of people's power.
Well, I guess that's what I mean by these self-sustaining bureaucracies. They're making a lot of money doing what they're doing.
Well, in the case of government people, perhaps not money, but certainly power. And behind that is simply what President Eisenhower famously called the military-industrial complex, except he called it the scientific military-industrial complex, not leaving out the national weapons laboratories and those who would continue to develop new kinds of weapons of mass destruction. But, you know, let's take a moment to say, I think the tide has turned. I just about an hour ago finished 30 years of work, the fourth and last volume of these nuclear histories that I've been writing now since 1979. And I was writing about the real possibility today, embodied in the public statements most recently of our new president, Barack Obama, for a new movement around the world toward reducing and eliminating all the world's nuclear weapons. I think we're finally beginning to turn this huge battleship of defense establishments in that direction. It's very exciting to think about. And when it's all done, we will live in a much more peaceful world. Because to convince countries like Israel or Pakistan, many others, Iran for that matter, even though it's not there yet, but it's certainly on its way, to convince them that they should not maintain a nuclear arsenal is going to require that we consider their security in common with ours. It's going to require common security, not on a bilateral level as between the Soviet Union and the United States, but on the scale of the rest of the entire world of nations. That's eminently doable. We're already there in many respects. I just today received an email announcing that the final signature on the Pelindaba Nuclear Free Zone Treaty has been delivered, and Africa, all of Africa south of the Sahara, is now a nuclear-free zone by treaty with all the countries involved. That means that the entire southern hemisphere of the world is now a nuclear-free zone. So in many ways, from the discussions between the U.S. and Russia to the new movement towards developing a treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons, to the development and spread of treaty-based nuclear-free zones, the world is moving toward a time when all the nuclear weapons will be gone. And I think as Reagan fantasized with Gorbachev at Reykjavik about going back to Reykjavik when the last two nuclear weapons were ready to be destroyed and having a little ceremony, he said, and then the whole world will have a tremendous party. And I think we're going to have that party one of these days.
It's very inspiring to hear you say that. There's a long gap between getting rid of nuclear weapons, of course, and having peace. We haven't dropped a nuclear weapon since 1945, and yet we have had anything but peace. Do you see the world moving in a less warlike direction?
Well, I think that's implied in the kind of security guarantees that would have to be devised to convince countries that have nuclear arsenals because they feel insecure to give up those arsenals. I mean, let's take Israel. Israel, I've seen estimates ranging from 80 to 300 nuclear weapons that the Israelis have built and deployed. They're surrounded by countries that have made it very clear that they would like to see Israel wiped off the map. In order for Israel to be prepared to give up what it conceives of as an existential defense, as a defense of its existence as a nation, those countries surrounding Israel, the whole Middle East, is going to have to find a way to resolve that dispute. One way that's already being discussed and that Israel has agreed to consider becoming a part of is that the Middle East would become another nuclear weapons free zone, where all the countries would agree through negotiation to eliminate their nuclear arsenals. Israel is willing, but only in the context of it, of guarantees of its national security, of its security as a country. Well, who would supply that security? Well, we might. Russia might. The United Nations might. There are lots of possibilities, but it would have to be credible and acceptable and maintained down through the years. Or inevitably, countries that had maintained nuclear arsenals before would once again feel the need to rebuild them. I'd like to point out that in a world without nuclear weapons, deterrence would still be in effect, but it would be delayed deterrence. You can think of a world without physical nuclear weapons as a virtual deterrent world, because the countries that know how to make nuclear weapons today aren't going to forget how to do that for a long time to come. And if they were threatened in a way that began to feel so serious that they felt they needed nuclear defenses, they would always have the option of withdrawing from such a treaty and going back to building nuclear weapons. So would their enemies. And under those circumstances, we would, over time, presumably just end up back where we are now, which would be the worst case scenario, rather than as it is now, the only case scenario. So it's not as if we're suddenly going to be naked to our enemies. The potential for building retaliatory capacity is going to be around for a long time for many countries throughout the world. The only question will be how much time it takes to deliver the warheads. Right now, it only takes 15 to 30 minutes, not enough time for any rational group of human beings to think about it. But if it took 6 months, there might be the possibility of finding other ways to settle the dispute, even if necessary with conventional warfare, rather than going back to nuclear weapons. It's a really rich and interesting subject. It's been obscured for many years by the dominance of the idea of deterrence, which is a lovely idea, except that it necessitates the maintenance of nuclear arsenals and therefore makes possible a catastrophic failure of deterrence in the form of a nuclear war. So deterrence is not such a great idea. And the idea of delayed deterrence is another matter.
Right. I mean, and not to mention the huge cost of it, yeah, as you mentioned before. All of these issues come into your play, or many of them that we've talked about, in one way or another. Why did you decide to write a play? What was your hope and intention in using this particular genre?
You know, I didn't have any kind of educational purpose in mind. I've written in a lot of different literary forms across my life. I started out as a novelist and a magazine journalist and turned to writing nonfiction only later, when I tried to write a novel about Los Alamos during the war and just simply couldn't make it work. And I realized I couldn't make it work because there was just too much information to put into a form like a novel. That's when I decided to try and write that book as a work of nonfiction. So one of the things was simply that I was struck in going through the documents from the Reykjavik summit at what a dramatic, I mean, it was almost classical. It happened in 2 or 3 days in one place between a limited number of people. That's almost like the classical Greek formula for a tragedy. And so much of what those two men and their advisors said to each other was instantly dramatizable with just a little bit of fiddling with the language. So it asked to be turned into a play, and I had never written a play before, and I liked the idea. And at that time, I was a friend of Paul Newman's, the actor. We had gotten to know each other when he played General Groves in the movie Fat Man and Little Boy. And I was telling him about how inherently dramatic the Reykjavik Summit was. I said, I'd really like to write a play about it. And he, without batting an eye, said, I'll help you with that. And he was kind of an informal advisor for me as I worked on the play. Typically, I would send him a draft, and he would send it back with a note that said, colloquialize. Mm. The language was very diplomatic in the documents, and I kept having to push away from being a historian and thinking as a dramatist and making these people speak to each other rather than speak through the formal language. So I hope I've done that. I may need to do some more.
Well, people are invited to come to the play and comment, because you will be there at the reading.
I will, and I'll talk a little bit afterwards about some of these things, and I hope people find it as interesting as it was for me to write.
Well, Richard Rhodes, thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Richard Rhodes, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of many books, including The Making of the Atomic Bomb, and his new play is Reykjavik, which will be performed tomorrow night, Tuesday, August 18th, at El Museo Cultural in Santa Fe. For more information, you can call 505-986-3910 or go to umbrellahat.org.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.